Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. Well, friends, we made it through another week. Hope you did, too. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. And hopefully you got to check out some good movies that are either new or new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we'll get to your list in a little bit. It's the grab a pencil portion of the show. I also do want to give a shout out and raise a glass to Jill Dittmeyer, my radio sister here at WFYI that passed away earlier this week. I miss being a part of Curious Mix, and I miss doing stuff with her in the studio and live on radio and on TV. And Jill, this one's for you. So miss you, sister. Okay, I have a special guest to fill it to hang out with me for a chunk of the show, because we're going to talk about a couple of recent Hollywood obituaries, or as we call it here, dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And I have an expert on a very specific film about a very specific subject. So joining me on the line is archaeologist, bookstore owner, and just all-around great person, Patty Glenn. Hey, Patty. Now, it also, full disclosure, Patty and I have worked on some theatrical productions as well as radio theatrical productions. So you've been warned. So if our banter sounds like things that are happening in the lobby of the Two Sisters bookstore in downtown Richmond, we'll try to explain all the insides jokes. So, okay. I want to start because at the time of this recording, we just found out about the passing of actor Christopher Plummer. And Patty, you told me before we went on the air that one of your all-time favorite films involves Mr. Plummer. Let's hear it.
It's Murder by Decree.
Ooh.
Surprise, surprise.
No, wait. First off, before we dive into that, tell a little bit, if you could, go ahead and plug the bookstore, The Two Sisters. That's you and Kate.
All right. So as you said, I'm one of the two sisters. It's a small bookstore in Richmond, Indiana. I do most of the kind of day-to-day running, and my sister is the brains of the operation. She's also a writer. Like that.
And what do you have in the back room?
Oh, yeah, okay, so this is probably part of the surprise, surprise.
Yes.
My sister left me in charge of decorating the shop, so the love of my life is Sherlock Holmes. And so the back room of our shop is this big Sherlock Holmes room. We've done a replica of his mantelpiece, and we've got pictures of some of our favorites and paintings and stuff like that, so... Hence, Murder by Decree, which happens to have Christopher Plummer as Sherlock Holmes.
And where does Christopher Plummer's Sherlock Holmes rank in Patty's list of Sherlock Holmes?
Ooh, he's up there. I mean, my all-time favorite Sherlock Holmes is Jeremy Brett.
Okay.
From the TV series, Christopher Plummer is really, really pretty far up there. I personally, and my family will be horrified by this, personally, I would put him on par with Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes and definitely in the top five. Like, he was really, really good.
Okay. And who is your favorite Moriarty?
Well, obviously you.
I got full disclosure. You're going to hear that a lot, folks. I got to play Professor Moriarty in a production of Sherlock Holmes, The Final Adventure at Richmond Civic Theater. And while one wall is filled with these photos of these men I don't know anything about, on the fireplace is a portrait of yours truly. So I'm very honored to be the first non-Holmes, non-Watson to be in the back room of the Two Sisters in Richmond, Indiana. I want to go through a few titles of what Plummer did, Patty, and if any titles pop up, you know, just chime in. Plummer is one of those, obviously, one of Canada's finest, and he also fell onto the thing of being, I think, always great, even if the material is not, but also was able to bounce back and forth between movies, the TV, and the stage, and especially up at Stratford, Ontario. I know there's been a lot of people talking about the performances that they got to see him do there, like King Lear, like Prospero. So anyway, going back to at least credits going back to the 1950s, before going to The Sound of Music, appeared in films like Stage Struck, Wind Across the Everglades, The Fall of the Roman Empire, and then The Sound of Music. Patty, where does The Sound of Music fall in the Glenn household?
Oh, we're not big musical people.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen it. it's not on my list it's a good musical. I acknowledge that it is a good film. It's a wonderful. I'm not a big fan.
Okay. Well, neither was Plummer, apparently. But no, he made fun of it, but said they did the best they could out with it. So
I did see The Fall of the Roman Empire. It was kind of mandatory watching for those of us who were classics majors. And also, he did an Oedipus the King.
Yes, 1968.
Yeah, it was Orson Welles and Lily Palmer. And that one I remember because we watched it in my Greek theater on film course. And the professor had this, like, massive man crush on Christopher Plummer. And, like, if anybody started talking, he'd be like, Christopher Plummer's talking! I'm like, all right. We were trying to ask a question. Like, no. That's kind of what I remember from that film.
Well, and if anything, at least with The Sound of Music, we have the great gif of him tearing up the Nazi flag. So there is that.
Yes. Yes, there is that.
Other titles from the 60s, we get Inside Daisy Clover, The High Commissioner, Lock Up Your Daughters, The Battle of Britain, which I believe had half the Screen Actors Guild in that. That was kind of required. Play the Duke of Wellington in Waterloo. That's the film with Rod Steiger as Napoleon, gang. The Spiral Staircase, Return of the Pink Panther, Rudyard Kipling, of course, in The Man Who Would Be King. We should never forget he's in that. I know it's the Sean Connery and Michael Caine show with John Huston, but yeah, he's pretty good in that as well. Aces High, International Velvet, The Silent Partner, Star Crash. Did you ever see Star Crash?
No, I have not seen that one.
Probably one of the bigger Star Wars ripoffs, and he got to be the Emperor. Murder by Decree.
Wait. Was it done as a Mystery Science Theater?
I believe it was. You probably have seen it then.
I think I've seen one of those then, yeah.
Because because Mr. Plummer usually doesn't wind up in Mystery Science Theater Riff Tracks fodder, but there's a few. Then, of course, the following year, 1979, he did Murder by Decree, as you mentioned, Hanover Street. So, and then in 1980, did you ever see Somewhere in Time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I have this theory that it seems like every generation has to have and I could go further back, but I'll start with Love Story. But like every generation has to have its like date weepy, you know, quote unquote girls' night film. And it's, you know, more recent memory, you have films like The Notebook and anything based off Nicholas Sparks and Finding Neverland and films like that. And I think Somewhere in Time definitely falls into that category.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
Yep. Eyewitness, Dreamscape, was the voice of Henry in An American Tale, was the villain in Dragnet. Of course, played a Klingon, also worked with Spike Lee and Malcolm X. I just posted on YouTube. He has a great couple of scenes as Mike Wallace in Michael Mann's film The Insider, 12 Monkeys, Dolores Claiborne, Wolf. Played Von. I forgot he did Van Helsing in Dracula 2000. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
You did.
I also saw him in, like, and it was one of those, I watched it because it was on, and I was, like, snowed in somewhere. I didn't have anything else to watch, but it was Nicholas Nickleby.
Ralph Nickleby, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I remember that, and I remember sitting there going, what is this? like, there were several actors in there where I was like, why are you in this? And if he was one of them.
Oh, man. Let's see. 2001 did the televised version of On Golden Pond with Julie Andrews, A Beautiful Mind, National Treasure. played Aristotle in Oliver Stone's Alexander. That's the one with, like, five different cuts of the film, the original Snyder version. The New World, of course, Must Love Dogs, The Lake House. First Academy Award nomination for playing Tolstoy in The Last Station, and then next year winning it for Beginners. The voice of Charles Munson, Up, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. He's the actor who didn't die while that film was being done. And, oh!
That's another one where, like, I saw it because it was on, sort of thing. and I'm still not entirely sure I can tell you what that movie's about.
Patty, I think that's the title of your film podcast. It was on.
I saw it because it was on, yeah.
Of course, in 2011, played your guy, John Barrymore.
Mm-hmm.
The girl with the dragon tattoo, Elsa and Fred. And, of course, played Scrooge in The Man Who Invented Christmas, or as I like to call it, Charles Dickens in Love. And then his last nomination, of course, in 2017 for filling it, you know, basically redoing all of Kevin Spacey's scenes in All the Money in the World. And still, oh, yeah, Knives Out in 2019. So,
which was really good.
It was a lot of fun. That's a good old fashioned 21st century take on the old parlor drama. So fun mm-hmm. stuff there. Any other favorites that came to mind?
No. We kind of named all the big ones.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, no. Murder by Decree. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
That's a good one. That's
Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper.
I think, and who's Jack the Ripper in that one?
Well, that's a spoiler.
Oh, then I can't. Yeah, we don't do that. So,
yeah.
That's
no,
right.
No, no. That's a massive spoiler. So.
Welcome to Film Sociology, your host of films that will not have 40-year-old spoilers. We don't want to do that. all right. Also, of course, passing away this week was actor Hal Holbrook. Even though he's dead, somewhere in the world, Mark Twain is being performed, no matter what. Going back to the 1950s, of course, he was in the series The Brighter Day. His first film credit was 1966 with the Sidney Lumet film of The Group. Of course, was in The Great White Hope. They Only Kill Their Masters. Do you remember, Patty, your first connection or your first encounter with the work of Hal Holbrook?
It's The Fog.
Really?
It was The Fog, and I saw it when I was a kid when I saw The Fog the first time.
I thought, wait a minute, you had to be on TV, because I was a kid when it came out in theaters.
No, we rented it. like on a VHS tape, and I remember we put it in, and I remember watching it, and I vaguely remember my parents kind of sitting there being like, ooh, we forgot how scary this film is. but that was kind of my introduction to, I like the film, it's a wonderful movie.
That's an underrated one.
Yeah. I'm not as familiar with Holbrook's work as Christopher Plummer. I saw him in North and South.
Right.
And All the President's Men, but that's kind of it.
Okay, that's all right. We'll go through some of these. My first two encounters with him was Lieutenant Briggs in Magnum Force, the second Dirty Harry film, because I watched Dirty Harry films as I was a kid. And then, yeah, as Deep Throat in All the President's Men. I remember my dad taking me to see Midway. He had a role in that as Commander Rochefort. He was in the film Julia. He was in Capricorn One. As we mentioned, The Fog, underrated John Carpenter film. It also, you know, it's the film that followed up Halloween, and that's a tough act to follow. Was in the Crates segment of Creepshow, also in the Star Chamber, and it became like the one of the elder statesman guys that you was always that always delivered off the bench. Wall Street, Fletch Lives, The Firm, of course, appeared on Designing Women with his wife Dixie Carter, as well as Evening Shade, Men of Honor, The Majestic, The Florentine. If you're into Johnny Depp, Water for Elephants. His only Academy Award nomination was for Into the Wild from 2007 and was working up until 2017. So salute to Hal Holbrook as well as to Christopher Plummer. Okay, now you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Patty Glenn is my guest, archaeologist, bookstore owner, and just really, really fun person. It's actually been out for, I think, a few weeks, but it's on Netflix, is a British drama called The Dig. And Patty, would you mind sharing with folks the background of the story of The Dig? Because every other film is based on a true story, and this is one of them.
Yes, sure. So The Dig is based on an excavation, a dig, surprise, surprise, from the 1930s, 1938, 1939. In Suffolk, England, which is in the east, and it was what turned out to be a ship burial at a place called Sutton Hoo, and so the main excavator was a guy called Basil Brown before sort of museum people came in and took over, and it was on the property of a woman named Edith Pretty, who they don't go into this in the film, but she actually was really into spiritualism, and so she apparently saw visions that she decided meant that she had to have the place excavated, and they found this just utterly magnificent ship burial as well as some other burials, and then World War II happened.
That gets in the way of things.
And then they wouldn't go back to excavate Sutton Hoo until like the 1960s because of that. But it was one of the most significant, if not the most significant, archaeological finds in British history in England. So it was a really big deal when it happened.
Okay. Well, and I reviewed this film earlier in January, and I have to admit, this was because I was in the rush of award screeners and I was seeing, you know, a lot of For Your Consideration stuff. I know first world problems, but it was, you know, 3-4 films a day. And I know I saw this in the middle of a marathon session, and I think it got lost in my mental shuffle. So when I knew that I was going to talk to you I should watch it again with fresh eyes. And I was able to do that on Thursday, and I'm really glad I did. I wound up liking the film a little more than I did. It's not perfect, and we'll get to that in a little bit. You mentioned was there also a documentary about this particular dig?
So there's a lot of,
Okay.
There's a lot of, documentaries you will find will focus on the helmet, which is probably the coolest thing that they found. But yes, there's a bunch of tons of little documentaries. Like if you just go to YouTube and type in Sutton Hoo documentary, you'll find all sorts of stuff on it.
Okay. Well, I want to start with, I guess we'll start with, since you're the guest, Patty, what did you think of the film?
Oh, I loved it.
Okay.
I absolutely loved it. It is I can see where some people might not, because it is definitely one of those films where like nothing happens and a lot happens at the same time.
Yes.
Which, funnily enough, is actually probably a good description of archaeology. I really enjoyed the film. It was well acted. It was beautifully done. There were a couple things I had a little bit of issue with, but by and large, I absolutely recommend the film to people.
Okay. I want to piggyback with you on that. I did, like I said, I mentioned, I did like the film the second time around more than the first. You can't deny really good performances from Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan, even though this is going to be known as the other Carey Mulligan performance from 2020. You know, that's a tough act to follow. But yeah, one of the things I noticed both times that I think I told you in the shop was there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of story going on because you have the dig itself, you have competition between the Ipswich Museum and Fine's character, Basil Brown, which is a very British name. And then London comes in. It's like the feds coming in on a you know, crime scene. You have, and by the way, it's not really a spoiler, but Carey Mulligan coughs within the first 15 minutes of the film. So it's like Kate Winslet in Finding Neverland. So, you know, that doesn't end well. And then we get to the love triangle, which I'll get to in just a moment. The film is directed by Simon Stone, who is a he had done the film called The Daughter. Ooh. And a couple other things, but he really, really likes Terrence Malick. There's a lot of handheld work with some funky lens activity going on. The only thing missing is Ralph Fiennes' hand gently going over some tall grass or weeds, or some, in this case, the dig itself. But I think the handheld work not only gets you in closer, but it makes it feel less BBC Masterpiece Theater. Your thoughts, Patty?
Yes, my probably biggest issue with the filming of it is when they would do that very artistic thing of one person talking, but they show you the other person.
Yeah, that's a Malick thing as well. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Like I. Yeah. That was definitely that. But yes, it felt more sort of like you are right there with those people, and you're in the trench with Basil Brown. Largely because of what, as you say, because they're doing handheld work and that sort of stuff. So yes, it did. It had the potential to be one of those BBC. Oh, we're here and we're doing British things.
Would you elaborate a little bit more with the Eddie Izzard definition of what British cinema is?
It's the one where how does he do it? They go in, they open up the door, and they're like, oh, Sebastian, you're here. And he goes, yes. What are you doing? Oh, I'm sorting my matches. He's like, oh, I better leave. Yes, you better have. And then he leaves.
Great acting, not a whole lot of activity. Although I wrote in my notes, and I knew I was going to ask you about this, there are moments of hot brushing action.
I will say this. Collapse of the walls,
mm-hmm.
when Ralph Fiennes gets buried, that actually the walls did collapse during one of the excavations, but it was really funny because we were sitting there watching this film and I was looking at it and I was like, hey, he should probably shore up those walls. He's a little too far. Like, that's way too far above his head for him to be digging in the... Ah, there we go.
It's tricks of the trade. You get to notice those things.
Yeah. So, and that actually... I want to give a massive shout-out to whomever built the kind of set for that. Like, because they recreated those excavations. Like, they made that ship spot on. Like, it looks exactly like the pictures from the excavation. Like, it was stunning.
Cool.
Good
to know.
Yeah. Like, I was absolutely stunned when they showed, like, the shots of the stuff. And there are even several shots that they do which are straight up, they recreated one of the photos.
Ooh.
From the excavation. So that was very impressive.
So when this comes out on physical media, there hopefully will be a slew of goodies and behind the scenes and shot by shot stuff, which one would hope for.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, and I mentioned there's a lot of story going on. Also, World War II. Just to remind you that there's World War II going on here. Now, since you've done a lot of study up on this, was there a love triangle at this dig?
No. This is the major issue I have with this film. I get why they include Johnny Flynn. Like, I get it. I get it. He's supposed to symbolize all the guys that are going off to war, and they don't know if they're coming back, and that's going to drive this home. But at the same time, like, this was something that I thought was a little amusing, is that the actual photographers on the dig were two women. And they got rid of them to write in the cousin, who's this love interest. And then it's also weird because I found out that the book that this is based on was written by the nephew of Peggy Piggott, Lily James's character.
Oh, jeez.
So there's a little bit of her, I'm like, okay. a little concerned about this. I mean, she did go on to, she did, she was actually a very famous archaeologist. She did eventually divorce the guy that's in the film, Stewart, and went on to marry this man with the most, I'm sorry, but the most wonderfully Italian name of Luigi Guido. And so, like, I actually know her work as Margaret Guido, and then they'll put in parentheses Peggy Piggott.
So you're saying Johnny Flynn couldn't play that character?
No, that was something. But yeah, so that was, like, I get it. You, like, they need to have some sort of a romance happen because everybody expects that.
Did they? Did they really? Because I watched.
I don't know.
Well, I know because we didn't make the film, and I know why they did. Well, because you're not going to get one between Fiennes and Mulligan, and there's. Well, and of course, Fiennes' character, Basil Brown, and his wife, they're not together. She's, you know, traveling in to help out. But yeah, so there is this love triangle between, yes, she mentioned, as Patty mentioned, Johnny Flynn, Lily James movie glasses. And as much as I like looking at Lily James with her knotted up work shirts and the movie glasses, and her fiancé father, played by Ben Chaplin, who would have played the Johnny Flynn role 25 years ago. And by the way, there is a moment from that is straight out of the Eddie Izzard bit about British cinema, because the fiancés, the engaged couple have two separate single beds, and then there's a moment where they have a non-argument over which bed to take.
Oh gosh, yes, I forgot about
that. And then Johnny Flynn, near the end, when he's called up, actually has to say the words, "I better go." And I just think, yes, I think you better shall. So yeah, there's so
the love triangle was a little weird.
It is a little weird.
And it kind of gets weirder the more you think about it.
Yeah, and there is, and don't worry, kids, there is a slight visual payoff at the end, but not really. You could have also shaved 15 minutes off this film without. Lily James movie glasses. Which
yeah, so that was. I actually, to be fair, did not recognize her until she started talking.
Okay.
I absolutely did. I mean, I realize I'm more than a little bit face blind, but like she popped on. I was like, "Who's this?" And then she starts talking, and I was like, "Whoa! Okay, that's Lily James."
Oh, so because I was going to ask you, is in the ranks of cinematic glasses wearing, where does this go? But apparently pretty effective if you didn't recognize her right away.
No, it was straight up Clark Kent effect. Like, that was, I had no idea who this person was.
You know what? I'm glad you said that, because I thought, because you and I both wear spectacles, and there are moments where you can tell, like, you don't wear glasses in real life. and unfortunately, in Ms. James's case, hopefully I'm wrong. Maybe she'll prove me wrong. I don't know. But I think, yeah, for me, I was thinking about the finest spectacle wearing in cinema. And I think Christopher Reeve in Superman is probably up there.
Oh, yeah. I'd buy that.
And we're still waiting for other actors playing Superman to play Clark Kent. Just we're waiting. We'll be over here. It's all right. So yeah, I mean, overall, I like the film more the second time around, flaws and all. So, and it's on Netflix. So, you know, go check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, Patty, I think Basil Brown, where are we as far as cinematic archaeologists? Where does Basil Brown rank? Is he passing, he's not passing Dr. Jones, but is he in the team photo?
Is that was the most archaeology film I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like, I was watching it and I was like, this is phenomenal. Like, this is archaeology. Like, it was, obviously, they do several things where one of my professors, famously, kept saying that if the process of archaeology, not what you're finding, but the process itself is entertaining, you are doing it wrong. And they definitely did that in this film, because they do several moments where, like, they do moments where you see them digging, but usually it's the setup for a conversation, and they have the conversation, and then they go back to digging, and as soon as they start digging again, they switch to something else, because it really can be very, very boring. And I absolutely loved that they did that. But yeah, no, in terms of like, as an archaeologist, yes, they did a really good job. Obviously, there are some things that they dramatized, but by and large, that was phenomenal. And I kept picking up bits and pieces where I was like, oh, they're doing this, or look, that's this thing, and that sort of stuff. And obviously, they're not running around raiding tombs. And
yes.
It's always nice.
And there's barley water.
Yes.
Now, when it's a rainy day, are you stuck in a little circus wagon with the head of the Ipswich Museum, or are you watching or listening to something else?
So fun. We usually, if it's lightning, like if you have a lightning, you have to stop work for 30 minutes. As I told somebody once, and they thought this was hilarious, I was like, you realize the true meaning of fear when you're in the middle of a field holding metal objects for other metal objects and lightning happens. You're like, this is absolutely terrifying. But no, for the most part, like when it starts raining, you have a rain delay sometimes if it rains hard enough, and you're usually stuck in crew vehicles. Or I actually did my field school over in England at an Anglo-Saxon dig, actually. It was a monastery, not a ship burial, but it started just pouring rain the way that it only rains in England. And we started with bailing out the trenches like they do in the movie with buckets. So you just get in and bail out the trenches. But it started raining so much that they stopped us and put us in a tent. And so we were stuck in this tent at the same time that they had just called over an expert to look at one of the things that we found. And so this guy who has like more titles than God was sitting there in this like tent with all these smelly, mud-covered archaeologists, and we're just sitting there drinking tea and waiting for the rain to go over. So that really, that definitely happens.
And counting matches.
And counting matches. Actually, another thing that was funny that happens in the film, and it happened on my field school, was they have to have the inquest, and they make the big deal about, oh, the inquest is coming, the inquest, and right. It's in the UK, they have this weird law that I'm kind of only vaguely aware of because I don't really do I don't do English archaeology anymore. I'm all in the U.S. and we don't have this, but they had if they discover the treasure had been buried intentionally, it usually like winds up belongs to the government. But if it had not been like if it had been buried without the intent to recover it, then it belongs to the landowner. And that was the whole big deal behind what was going to happen to that treasure that they were pulling out of the dig in the dig, was that they actually had to decide who does this belong to. And they gave it to Edith Pretty, and then she donated it to the British Museum, which was unexpected.
And eventually Brown got credit for it.
Eventually, yes. I think I was in college when they first started giving him credit.
Ooh.
I actually had a professor who was obsessed with Basil Brown, which is actually how I found out about him. And my professor for the archaeological theory course would contrast Basil Brown as an excavator versus like Heinrich Schliemann, who excavated Troy. Because Heinrich Schliemann did not excavate Troy so much as just plow through until he found stuff. And then had a really good PR department. Whereas Basil Brown was meticulous as an excavator. He was just thoroughly meticulous, very, very thorough, kept copious notes. And so that was one of the things that we were taught in school, or that I was taught in school, was that you want to be more like Basil Brown if you're digging.
And then how was the casting of Fiennes as Brown?
Oh, he was amazing, but it's also Ray Fiennes.
Yeah, there is that. So it's
yeah, but no, he was really really good. And as far as I know about like the stuff that I do know about Basil Brown, he seemed to have kind of nailed them. Like he did a good job. I did think it was funny that throughout the film, "Don't be sad" was in a 50-mile radius of that house because Basil Brown will appear and dispense wisdom at you.
Yes.
Like, it was good. He did a great job, but it was really funny because it's like somebody gets sad and then suddenly there's Ray Fiennes.
Well, it's the anti-Voldemort. It just shows up and gives mm-hmm. you good reassurance. So. It's funny you mentioned as far as the rules when it comes to treasure. I just watched a Fellini film called Il Bidone, which is about three con artists. And one of their cons is going to houses in the country dressed as priests, saying that there is a treasure that was buried on their property that may have involved a murder, and they don't want the police in on it. So if the landowner would give them some money to pay for masses for the dead that happened in this murder case, that the household could keep the treasure. And so anyway, that was slight offshoot, but that reminded me of that. Now, wrapping up on The Dig, I jokingly refer to this film as Lily James Movie Glasses. And the only reason why I call it that is because you inspired me on your alternate title for the last Star Wars film. If you could share that with the audience.
Oh, it's not my title. That's the thing. There was a woman behind us when I watched it the first time, and Kylo Ren appears at the end and he's Ben Solo again. And this woman who was sitting near us said out loud, "Why is he in a boyfriend sweater?" It was the funniest thing I had heard, because it's kind of like he is. That is how he appears. And which is hysterical, but at the same time, like, character is technically a space Nazi, and somehow that translated apparently to space Nazi in a boyfriend sweater in Matt's brain.
Yeah, I think space Nazi boyfriend sweater and Lily James acting movie glasses, that's a fun double bill.
Yeah, I can see that.
There you go. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org, talking with Patty Glenn, actual archaeologist, not movie archaeologist, and co-owner of the bookstore The Two Sisters in downtown Richmond. Is it twosisters.org?
No, actually, we don't have a website.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's the number so people can call you and ask you about books you may or may not have?
So the phone number is 765-935-4670.
And it's like a bookstore. It's like Clerks, only it's a bookstore and not a convenience store sometimes. No comment. We'll move on.
No, I'm not
going to
touch that one.
No, it's okay. We'll save that for the lobby. It's all right. So you alluded to it a little bit. What, growing up and or currently, what is movie night like with the Glenn family at the Glenn house?
Oh, gosh. Usually it's we pick a film. Sometimes it's because we've seen some actor's name pop up in something and we're like, we want to watch this, or someone remembers having seen it, and we go and we watch it, and everyone sits down and we get popcorn and we watch the film. And there's also usually a lot of commentary that goes on where we're like, hey, this thing. Like The Dig, there was a lot of me pausing and going, oh, okay, so they're doing this. Sort of explanations and that sort of thing.
And I guess also to jump on Eddie Izzard, if this was done in America, it would be shot for $100 million and it would be called The Dig from Hell.
It is a very British film. I found it very calming. I will give this, you kind of gave the spoiler that Edith Pretty coughs during the film.
Well, yeah.
She lived for a very long time after that. I think, like, she lived well into the 60s, if I remember correctly. Like, the whole film is very much, like, centered on human mortality and kind of the cycles of life and death and how do you deal with grief and that sort of stuff, which is, funnily enough, very Anglo-Saxon. But yeah, like, they really emphasize that she's dying, and I remember sitting there thinking, she didn't die. Like, she lived a long time after that.
But there is kind of a really kind of sappy moment involving the location, and I don't want to give away more than I already have, but I guess it was easier to have Carrie Mulligan cough in the first 15 minutes than try to put old age makeup on her at the end.
Yeah.
Well, just... there is that, so.
Yeah.
So, growing up, what was movie time like with your mom, and what was movie time like with your dad?
Oh, okay. I get where you're...
Leading the witness.
leading the yes. This is very much leading the witness. So my mom, with my mom, we would watch, you know, we'd watch all the family films, and a lot of mysteries and that sort of stuff. But my dad was a particularly big fan of Errol Flynn movies, and so. I think I was the only elementary kid in our elementary to have seen like The Adventures of Robin Hood by the time I was like 12. we'd watch tons and tons of those. When my grandfather was still alive, we used to watch westerns together, which is kind of what you do with your grandfather. You watch, you know, and so we would watch a lot of those. Our family was very big on the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes, who's another one of my all-time favorites. A lot of mystery films, a lot of action and adventure. What I'm assuming you are attempting to get me to say is, yes, we watched a lot of Errol Flynn.
Now, there's a handful of we're going to dig into an inside joke, but there are only a handful of actors in the history of cinema that can get away with flying into a scene and starting a line with ha ha ha. And Errol Flynn's on that list. Who do you think also qualifies for that list?
No.
Just Errol Flynn. Not a Barrymore?
No, I honestly think that...
Not Howard Keel?
No, I think Errol Flynn was kind of one of the only people who could have done that. It takes a very specific kind of man to be able to do that. And I think Errol Flynn was probably it.
I know. I believe, and Hugh Jackman tried to pull it off in an animated feature, but that's an animated feature. One who attempted to do it and did not, and I'm going to let you tell the story, was apparently Tom Hiddleston.
Oh, gosh, yes. He might be able to pull it off. People reviewing the Thor film, and at the very end, when he's in the fight with Thor, he does this laugh, and the people are like, did he just go ha-ha? And then a little bit later on, he does it again, and they're like, that's too many ha-has for a film not involving Errol Flynn. And I was one of the funniest things I think I'd ever heard, and unfortunately, like, he does it a lot. I did not notice it until that moment, and every so often, you'll hear him go, ha-ha. And it's this very swashbuckly laugh. And it is, again, it takes a very specific kind of person to pull that off, and he manages to do it. But yes, that is ha-ha.
There's not that many 21st century swashbucklers in cinema.
No, which is really sad. Because that's another wonderful genre.
The swashbuckle. Is there a swashbuckle section of the shop?
We have Raphael Sabatini novels, if in any given Errol Flynn movie, it's probably based on one of those. There was once where I sat down and watched every film that was based on a Raphael Sabatini novel.
And how'd that go? How'd that work out for you?
Really well. Scaramouche, the movie has nothing to do with the book, apart from the names are the same. Though Scaramouche the movie has one of the best sword fights in the history of cinema. When they're up on the balconies and they're like going all around the opera house, and it was utterly amazing sword fight. Not that great of a film.
But you come for the just stay for the sword fight.
Yeah, or just look it up on YouTube because that was really, really well done.
So there was, for a while, at the Two Sisters bookstore, you also had, and you'll have to correct me on this, it seemed like you had cinematic literary bohunks every month.
Yes, and actually, funnily enough, started because of Tom Hiddleston. this is funny, and I do not, whatever gets people reading, there was a space of time where there were all these, I do not wish to be stereotypical, but there were all these teenagers and early college kids who were coming into the store requesting the Shakespeare play Coriolanus. And I was shocked because that's not exactly one of the ones that people request a lot.
Yet alone teenagers.
Let alone teenagers. And I was like, well, maybe it's for a class. And then there were a couple of them who asked for it, and when they got the book, like, started giggling. And it's that giggle word that was enough to make me go, ah, who's in this? And looked it up, and lo and behold, it was Tom Hiddleston was in a play, which was phenomenal. If you get to see the National Theatre Live version, they just started up a subscription service. You can watch it. So that was really, really funny. And we're like, and my sister and I thought to ourselves, well, if that's what it takes. And so we started up this thing called the Monthly Movie Crush. And so we'd pick an actor who had done stuff based on literature. We'd get all the stuff, all the books that he'd been in, and we'd put them on the mantelpiece. And with a little picture of him in a heart-shaped frame, and then a list of all the films that he's been in and that sort of stuff. And we had, and we did that. We did that for about a year until we ran out of actors that we had seen stuff with. Like, all right, moving on.
Wasn't Leslie Howard on that group?
Leslie Howard was, Yes, Leslie Howard is on the movie. He's one of my favorite actors. But yes, he was on the group, and he actually holds the title of the actor who sold the most books.
Do you have to send commission to his family, to the lawyers?
I don't know. Maybe if they hear this, demand one. No. It was really funny. I mean, people thought that was cool, and they'd come back in, and they'd be like, you know, we saw this, and we read the book, and that was really neat, and... Leslie Howard was on the list.
Colin,
you'd expect, like,
Colin Firth,
Humphrey Bogart. Trying to think, it's just kind of all the ones that you'd expect to be on the list were there. And I'm trying to think of what some of the other, like, kind of actors, but Cumberbatch sold the most by a single author because of all the Sherlock Holmes ones,
of course.
Yeah, of course. Who's another all-time favorite actor? Absolutely adore him. There is a tie. This is kind of funny.
Yeah.
For the biggest book sold by an actor.
You mean as far as pages or volume or weight?
Yeah, pages, size, weight, whatever. There is a tie between Adam Driver, who sold a copy of Don Quixote. And Josh Groban, who was responsible for the selling of a copy of War and Peace, which I thought was absolutely hysterical, because that musical is only based on like 50 pages of a really, really big novel.
yes, got it. Wait, so no book sales of silence?
No book sales of silence.
I'll start. I'm sure I'll catch hell for this, but one of Mr. Glenn's favorite actors is Adam Driver, and there's a long, fun story behind that if Patty wants to share. But he is up for watching almost any Adam Driver film except one, and somebody tells me to stop recommending it to her parents. That would be you, right?
Yes, that would be me. Yeah, it's Silence, which was an absolutely well done film, except. It's really, really quite depressing at times. And it is absolutely not a film that my father would enjoy watching. And it was, again, one of those films that I saw because it was on. Because thank you, archaeology, we wind up getting stuck in hotel rooms a lot when you're out on projects. And so usually I'll turn on the TV and just whatever's on HBO, I'll watch it. And that was how I saw Silence. And yes, my father, it's a long story, but my father became a big fan of Adam Driver. We all kind of became a big fan of Adam Driver, but I think Dad might love him a little bit more. And, Matt keeps threatening to show him Silence.
No, I'm not going to threaten the show. I'm not going to show it to him. I allude to it, but I won't threat. Okay, you mentioned your group when there's a delay. What movies have gone over well with your digging group? Which is really not a technical term. I apologize.
Crew is kind of...
Crew, thank you. That's,
crew.
That's great.
So the thing is that archaeologists come from such a wide variety. Like, I've worked with people from all over the world. It's kind of a little bit of everything. Action films go down very, very well. One of the running gags that we have as an icebreaker when there are new people on the crew is to ask them, what is your favorite Marvel film, and why is it Thor Ragnarok? Yeah, because it was before Thor Ragnarok. Everybody was just like, oh, this is my favorite Marvel film. And then we noticed that everyone just kept saying Thor Ragnarok. So we were, okay, apart from that one, what is your favorite? And so, like, you can go pretty much any crew and talk about, like, the Marvel films and stuff like that. Those are immensely popular. The Dig actually went down very well with all of my coworkers. In fact, the only like negative review I read from one of my coworkers was one who did not like that they emphasized the conflict between Ralph Fiennes, Basil Brown's kind of blue collar worker, and the Cambridge boys, as I keep referring to them, who were all the big wig art intellectuals who come in and kind of take over the Dig. And I was trying to process that before I realized that this person is themselves an academic archaeologist. That makes a bit more sense. This person is not happy with that. But apart from that, the film received glowing reviews from all of my coworkers.
Cool. And I know you posted on my page, but just curious, Patty Glenn, what have you been watching recently?
Well, we've been doing all the Star Wars films in order.
wait, which order, though?
The chronological order.
Okay.
And we just finished The Rise of Skywalker, so we just finished that one. What else have we been watching? We're kind of old random films. We have a tendency of, I refer to it as an actor endurance challenge. And it's, you pick an actor that you like, mm-hmm. and you get a list of everything they've been in, and you start at the top with the highest rated, and you go all the way down and see how far down you're willing to, like, go down on that list for that actor. And it usually surprises you. But so we usually find, like, random actors that we get obsessed with, and we wind up watching all these kind of old films with them in it.
Give us an example. Yeah. Give us an example. This would be fun.
There was one, and actually I will, yes, there was one. His name is Marius Goring, and he was this British actor in, like, the 1930s, 1940s, into the 70s. And he was in this film, I think it's The Woman Who Screamed, I think was the name of it. And he played this just thoroughly insane upper-class British guy and he did this phenomenal job of switching between being completely sane, exactly how you would expect an upper-class British person, posh boy, to be, and then crazy. Like, in a blink of an eye, he's crazy. And we loved that film, and then just started finding everything we could find with him in it, which has taken us into some very strange, like, made-for-TV movies and stuff. But yeah, so that was really good. We've also went through a bit of a James Mason kick.
Why does God sound like James Mason?
I have no idea.
Thank you, Eddie Izzard, for that one.
And also, I enjoy getting up a little early on Sundays and watching Noir Alley on TCM.
Yes.
Yep. So that, yeah, and they recently showed, Witness to Murder. That was it. They showed Witness to Murder with George Sanders, who's another one of my all-time favorite actors. And that was really, really, really good.
And the Mr. Freeze.
Yes.
One of three for you nerds out there who are out there. So I know your sister, not so much in the noir, and I also know we need to talk about her book, or else we will both catch hell for this. So,
also, I already caught a bit of flack. Apparently, she does like noir.
We stand corrected.
Yes. She was like, I like those films. And I was like, oh, okay, you never want to watch them. No, I like them. So,
Dear Bravo, Two Sisters series, please.
But yes, no, my sister, do you want to introduce the book or shall I?
Oh, please, no, you do it. You're in the family more than closer than I.
Okay. Yes, so my sister wrote a book. It's called The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway. It's a fantasy novel, and so it's about a history teacher who falls from our universe into a parallel universe where he meets up with these airship pirates, which is this wonderfully eccentric crew of airship pirates. And attempts to get home, and that's as far as I can go without spoiling the novel.
Yes, so and it's a part of a trilogy. There's two books out right now, and they're both, of course, available at the Two Sisters bookstore. But yeah, if I'll do it since I'm the host. But if you're a fan of swashbuckling and Doctor Who and British fantasy, or even more, double British fantasy. These are the books for you. And there's also been a stage play made of this, adapted by my lovely wife, as well as a Richmond Radio Works play. One of the voices was my lovely daughter. But yeah, the Adventures of Martin Hathaway and part of a trilogy. So you can call the Two Sisters and find out. I guess, aren't the books also available on Amazon?
Well, yes, we don't talk about that.
We do not talk about that, even though the guy's stepping down, but we don't talk about that. But no, make the trip to Wayne County and check out a really fun bookstore. You also, by the way, you also have a little fun feature in the shop if you're a fan of Harry Potter.
Oh, yes. So we have, in our children's section, we have a little cupboard under the stairs that's designed to look a bit like the Harry Potter cupboard. Which was, funnily enough, it was when we first opened the shop and we were first looking at the place, I was staring at this cupboard thinking, oh, great, we have a just gigantic broom cupboard in the middle of our store. What are we going to do? And my sister, hit me on the arm, was like, it's the Harry Potter cupboard! So that was funny.
How have things been at the shop during the pandemic?
Surprisingly good. We do. When the pandemic first started, we naturally shut down like everybody else. And then we were doing curbside pickup. So, we'd wrap up your books and take them outside for you. And then we discovered, I'm trying to say this without dragging politics into all this.
Fair enough.
Towards the end of last year and into the start of this year, we noticed a massive uptick of people who would come in. They'd be, we do require masks, but they would come in to kind of be here for quite some time. And we realized that it was because it was a nice kind of quiet, safe place with quiet music playing. And so people were enjoying it as that, which, funnily enough, we kind of would appreciate another crisis happening because that was a fun time. We've been doing pretty well. We're certainly much better off than some other bookstores, not in here in Richmond, but a lot of our colleagues in the business are not doing as well. And that's all I have to say about that.
Very good. Understood. So once again, give folks the information on the Two Sisters.
So the Two Sisters bookstore. It's a bookstore owned by myself and my sister. Our father will probably be in here if neither of us can. but it's in Richmond, Indiana. It's in the Depot District. We're open 9 to 7 every day but Sunday. And we have a little bit of everything, and if we don't have it, we can definitely try and order it in.
Nice. And the phone number for people to call?
765-935-4670.
Very good. Patty, I really appreciate you coming on and bringing your expertise of digging archaeology and space Nazi boyfriend sweaters and cinematic literary bohunks. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Patty Glenn, archaeologist and co-owner of the Two Sisters Bookstore, which is located at 193 Fort Wayne Avenue in Richmond, Indiana, 765-935-4670. That was fun. I enjoyed that. Thanks, Patty. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we get into the grab a pencil portion of the show, just wanted to let you know what I've been watching over the last week. And it has been a long week, friends, I assure you. Hopefully, I'll be better next week compared to last week. But one of the titles I got to experience, and it's a collaboration between ESPN Films and NFL Films, is Al Davis versus the NFL. And it's really the rivalry between former Oakland, Los Angeles, Las Vegas Raider, well, he died before they went to Vegas, but Raiders owner Al Davis and former NFL commissioner Pete Rozelle, and a rivalry that these two had for decades, and Davis always going against the grain of the league, and as far as going back to when he was a part owner of the Raiders, and litigations began against, he filed lawsuits against other teams, and then he wanted to move his Oakland Raiders down to Los Angeles, which caused a ripple effect in other teams. Well, if you're in Indianapolis, you thank Al Davis for moves like that. It's interesting because I had just watched the week before the fun documentary Best of Enemies, which was the rivalry between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. And it's similar that this would be a fun double feature to watch. And I knew that there was a rift between Davis and Rozelle. I didn't have all of the rounds of conflict that these two had, and that's what this film provides. It's under 80 minutes long, and it talks about the impact of the feud as well as in the football business in the NFL. So I got to wind up experiencing more about this rivalry between those two and liked it very much. It's not perfect. There is moments of a CGI version of both characters, and they're deliberately put in shadows. And you have two actors who are doing imitations of both of Davis and Rozelle. And after watching, I go back to Best of Enemies, the text by Gore Vidal was narrated by John Lithgow, not doing an imitation of Gore Vidal. And Kelsey Grammer was doing the voiceover for William F. Buckley, not doing an imitation of Buckley. I wish the filmmakers of Al Davis versus the NFL had watched Best of Enemies and just gone with the voices. I didn't need the CG. And there's a final moment at the end that acknowledges that both men are now dead. And it's kind of a really silly, cheesy reunion. That aside, and I don't need Jerry Jones in my closing credits. You know, I think Al Davis would be ticked off if the, you know, a voice of the Cowboys was one of the last voices in the film and not him. Anyway, that's the only flaw really with the film. But if you're a sports fan or if you just like rivalries, check out the ESPN Films NFL Films documentary, Al Davis versus the NFL. And I've been starting to dig into my Fellini box set from Criteria, the Criterion Collection. And, of course, they're going in chronological order, as I've mentioned. And I started with 1950. I did talk about Varsity Lights. That's where we have the traveling circus, traveling road show. I mentioned The White Sheik. And then I finally got to La Strada, which I had seen before with Giulietta Masina and Anthony Quinn. Another example of neorealism from Federico Fellini, where this time the girl is running away to join the circus, sort of. She's being sold to a sideshow strongman by her mother. Right out of the gate, we find out that in this particular poverty-ridden family, that the oldest daughter has died, apparently mom's favorite, and that the second oldest and not favorite is sold to this strong man played by Anthony Quinn. And they go on the road mostly for themselves, and eventually they wind up joining a circus company. And he treats her like garbage, but she stays with him and winds up becoming a little bit of a performer herself, but is stuck in this not great relationship, working or physical or emotional relationship. And It does take a dark turn, as if that wasn't dark enough. It does take an even darker turn in the final quarter, but good performances from Messina and Quinn. And this was one that won Best Foreign Film for Fellini back in the mid-50s. Also in 1955, one I had not seen before, but Il Bidone, which is stars Broderick Crawford and Richard Basehart, who is also in La Strada, about aging con. Crawford plays an aging con artist. And I mentioned this with Patty, and the job is not coming up to snuff with him. We find out as time goes on, the Basehart character is married and has a daughter. Crawford has a grown daughter he's estranged from. He and his wife are long ago separated. And what happens when jobs aren't quite working out the way they should? And it's not a fun heist film. It's not Ocean's 11. It's not Soderbergh's Ocean's 11. But I think it's probably a neorealism very quick definition. Neorealism, you have stories of the poor and the working class, or in this case, you know, struggling con artists, usually filmed on location, usually with non-actors, and mixed in with the actual actors. So I would say that Nomadland is a bit of neorealism. That was my favorite film from last year. But I had forgotten that Broderick Crawford had done some films in Italy. So it was good to see him in this. And so if you're it's like this is the flip side of the, you know, fun con artist films, just like The Spy Who Came In from the Cold is the flip side of the James Bond saga. So anyway, I got to see those from the Federico Fellini collection from Criterion. That's 1955's Il Bidone. And I will hopefully have some more Fellini chats, or at least quips to give you in the next several weeks. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, friends, grab a pencil. It's that time of the show where I go over the movie titles that you have been watching via Facebook, Twitter, and email. And hopefully you've had a combination of new or at least new to you films, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we start, as usual, on email from my buddy Eric, who is in his rewatch mode of Hitchcock films, starting with the excellent 1956 film The Wrong Man, that's starring Henry Fonda and Vera Miles, as well as the great 1958 film Vertigo, Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak. And then made for TV, he revisited or watched RKO 281, that's the film with Liev Schreiber as Orson Welles, and the series Yellowstone from Paramount Network. So there you go there. Thank you, Eric. Always appreciate that. We now move over to Twitter. And our very own Pam Elliott writes, watch Bombshell, great acting. That's my phone. Watch Bombshell with the 19-year-old daughter. At first, I was uncomfortable with how raw it was, but at the end, we talked about how courageous women who help peel back layers of harassment for us. Movies can spark important and sometimes difficult discussions with your young adult. Thank you, Pam. I'm with you on that one, very much so. Chewy Walrus writes, as promised, watch the entirety of Amy Heckerling's filmography, along with the Trousdale Wise Disney films and the oeuvre of Dees Reese. When I had time, I also watched the F. Gary Gray Italian Job and Groundhog Day. So thank you, Chewy Walrus. Let's see. Oh, so here are the titles that he's put out on a list, a visual list. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, The Last Thing He Wanted, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Oliver and Company, Hercules, Mudbound, Groundhog Day, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, Beauty and the Beast, Bessie, Pariah, The Italian Job, Vamps, I Could Never Be Your Woman, Loser, Clueless, Look Who's Talking Now, Look Who's Talking To, Look Who's Talking, God, National Lampoon's European Vacation, Johnny Dangerously, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Thank you, Chewy Walrus. Jay Walden writes Hillbilly Elegy. And I think that's it for Twitter. So there we go. Now moving over to Facebook. Of course, there's always people that wrote days after the post from last week. So we start with Thomas, who says, finally got to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Joe writes The Watchmen. Angela writes The Old Guard, The Silence, Extraction, and Horse Girl. Lisa writes Wish You Well, The Dig, and The Midwife, which she says is a French film. Jennifer writes Judy. Craig writes Joy Noel. Eric writes The Sound of Metal. Enjoyed it on many levels. That's my phone. You see, I got a new phone, and I haven't figured out how to mute the phone yet because I'm old. I need my daughter to help me with that. I've reached that age in life. Yeah, I'm that commercial. Very funny. I don't read books about submarines. Randy writes, Man with a Movie Camera. Devin writes, the 2003 Peter Pan, as well as Hook. Pat writes, The Little Things. John writes, Anna with Jessica Chastain. Joshua writes, The Little Things, Ad Astra, One Night in Miami, episodes 1 through 4 of WandaVision, season 1 of Ted Lasso, Mank, and The Dig. J. Kevin writes, Eyes Wide Shut and Lolita. Michelle writes, Epic. John writes, Radio Days, my first Woody Allen film. Really, John? Wow. I know you're of a certain age, so congratulations, better late than never, but that's a good early first start. That's an easy one to kind of fall into. My daughter's first Woody Allen film was Midnight in Paris, and then tried to do the older titles like Take the Money and Run, Sleeper, Play It Again, Sam. Didn't quite go over as well. And then it wasn't me, but my wife showed Emma Annie Hall, telling her, you'll get a lot of your dad's humor once you watch this. And she did. So anyway, cool. One of my favorite things to say about working in radio is from there's a great scene in Radio Days, and it's the scene of the Masked Avenger. And it's about perspective, perception, what people think you look like because of your voice. And there's a great scene where the camera's panning across a live radio play happening. It's a big action play. There's guns and there's swords clanging. And Woody Allen narrates, saying that his favorite show was a show called The Masked Avenger, who he envisioned was a cross between Cary Grant and Superman. And the voice of the Masked Avenger was Wallace Shawn. So, John, anyway, long story long, congratulations on your first Woody Allen film. I know nobody says that in 2021. Dave writes, The Dig rocks, seasons 1 through 3, I think, of Schitt's Creek, with the two T's. Finding Obama, Inception. And he writes, we just signed up for Netflix. There you go. Larkin writes, Patch Adams. Darren writes, Mank, and may PETA and Pamela Ferdin forgive me. Something called Zebra in the Kitchen. Though, to be clear, we stumbled in this particular horror and riff-tracked it from the couch from beginning to end. And Todd writing in, Zebra in the Kitchen is just awful. Cassie writes, Avengers Endgame. Nancy writes, The Little Things and Groundhog Day. Adam writes, Avengement. Jonathan writes, I Married a Witch and The Little Things. Chris Lloyd writes, Little Fish, Two of Us, Elizabethtown, Thor, Thor the Dark World, and The Wanting Mare. And apparently, if you're a fan of the film app, and you should be, Chris Lloyd is going to be writing a column about Elizabethtown very, very soon. Kara writes, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and Soul. Joe writes, The Dig, Vikings Seasons 4 and 5, and All Creatures Great and Small. Michael writes, One Night in Miami. Denise writes, Ponyo, I Know This Much Is True, which has scenes filmed in the state-run institution in New York where I did my internship. Thank you, Denise. Monica Hartz, regular on this show, Lady Hawk, The Right Stuff, and The Hunt for Red October. Did you show BB any of those? And if you did, it was probably Lady Hawk. Amy writes, Matthew, I really enjoyed Juanita on Netflix, starring Alfre Woodard, Adam Beach, and cameos by Blair Underwood. Kay writes, Watch The Dig, Penguin Bloom, and Love Happens. Adrian writes, Loved The Dig and My Octopus Teacher. Many tears for both. Jared writes, Seabiscuit. Adrian writes, Groundhog Day. Duh, I got you, babe. Dustin writes, Saturday Night Fever, The American President, Marvin's Room, the TV film version of Wit. That's the one with Emma Thomas. All three Lord of the Rings, all three Hobbits, Get On Up, and The Fresh Air, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air Reunion. Busy week there, Dusty. Andrew writes, Have I mentioned Cinderella with Lily James? On second viewing, it vastly improved. Patty, well, you know Patty Glenn, The Dig, The Rise of Skywalker, and Mystery Science Theater 3000, Colossus and the Headhunters. Wow. Alan writes, I Spit on Your Grave, the remake. Really, Alan? Wow. Whew. Lou writes, South Pacific, Kismet, The Little Things, and In and of Itself. Phil writes, watched Waiting for the Barbarians last night. Joan writes, I was with friends over the weekend when I made an Office Space reference. They had no idea what I was talking about, so I told them to come out from under the rock that they'd been living under and watched it. They, of course, loved it. Thank you, dear. Mario writes, Dr. No. Kaylin writes, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, The Wildening, Patch Adams, Call of the Wild, and Inside Out. Megan writes, The Godfather, and then put in parentheses, Because My Father Made Me. Megan, I told Emma we were going to watch The Godfather for Father's Day. That was one of my Father's Day presents to myself, and she fell asleep half hour into it. So, yeah, dad films. Erica writes, I'm pretty sure we always have the weirdest movies. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Last night, we watched 0 to 60 on YouTube. Ooh. 1978, written by and starring Darren McGavin, also starring Denise, Violet Beauregard-Nickerson, Sylvia Miles, Joan Collins, and the Hudson Brothers, who also did two songs for the movie. McGavin scripted an uncomfortable number of scenes of himself in his underwear and being drooled over by various women. I'm not sure we'll ever see him the same way again. So there you go, Christmas Story fans. Go check that out if you want to see the old man. Abby writes, All In, The Fight for Democracy, and Owned, A Tale of Two Americas. Janet writes, Inside Out, Tower Heist, Street Gang, How to Get to Sesame Street documentary, Coda, Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go for It. Tiffany writes, Jojo Rabbit, Boy, and What We Do in the Shadows. Lila writes, Groundhog Day, duh. Don writes, Don Hipschweiler, WFYI's own Don Hipschweiler, writes The Dig. Don writes, another Don, not Don Hipschweiler, Social Dilemma, The Vanish, The Dig, Night in Miami, and One Night in Miami, and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Doug writes the animated and live-action versions of Aladdin, Coco, Double Trouble. Ooh, not one of Elvis's best. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, It's Always Fair Weather, Mamma Mia, and Saturday Night Fever. Taylor writes The Dig, Avengers Endgame, Get Shorty, The Dub Room Special, The Martian, Stalag 17, and Isle of Fury. Jed writes, Finally watched Hamilton, really enjoyed it. Denise writes, Drumline, and trivia question for you film fans, Drumline and Guardians of the Galaxy both feature what actor slash actress and what song? So there you go, trivia from Denise. William writes, Escape Plan 2, Hades, Escape Plan, The Extractors, Escape Plan 3, Lucky Day, and 10 Minutes Gone. Michelle writes, Cloverfield, 28 Days Later, Hitchcock, Hitch, not related, Places in the Heart, and Maverick. Scott writes, Public Enemy, that's the James Cagney film, Casablanca, and both versions of The Boys in the Band. I watched the remake of Boys in the Band, the revival of Boys in the Band, earlier last month, and also like that. I need to revisit William Friedkin's version. Michelle writes, Blackbird. Rachel writes, Broken Arrow. Jackie writes, The Dig. Samuel writes, Deadpool 2. The whole movie is worth it for that 1 second Brad Pitt electrocution cameo for which purposely Pitt's only fee was to have Ryan Reynolds personally bring him a cup of coffee. Okay. Jamie writes, Kai and I have been watching a lot of ghost adventures. Christian writes, My octopus teacher was great. Matthew writes, Little Things, The Highwaymen, and Extraction. Jay writes, We watched Palmer. Loved it. JT did a good job, and the little boy did awesome, too. Highly recommended. Howell writes, Beer Fest, a movie best seen when drunk. Thank you, Howell. Matthew writes, Searching for Bobby Fischer. Mark writes, The Dig, The Big Short, The Bourne Supremacy. Why does Jason Bourne never employ a disguise? Not so much as a dang hat. Yeah, Mark, but for one film, for one, he, you know... For one film, though, he was disguised as Jeremy Renner. Austin, oh, by the way, I got a note from Austin Glidden. By the way, check out his podcast, Medium Cool, a movie podcast. This week was part two of the discussion of the top 10 films of 2020 with Joe Shearer of the Film Yap and yours truly in Austin. It was a long Sunday, but we got two shows out of it, so very cool. Anyway, this week, Austin checked out War for the Planet of the Apes, Kong Skull Island, Godzilla King of the Monsters, The Little Things, Spider-Man Far From Home, Split, The Dig, Crack Cocaine, Corruption and Conspiracy, Crack Hyphen, Cocaine, Corruption and Conspiracy, Palmer, and Vampire Hunter D. Britt writes Grease, Grease 2, Byzantium, Striptease, and Miss Fisher and the Crypt of Tears. Frank writes Anon, excellent noir meets mystery meets Gattaca. Excellent, perfectly fit film score as well. Thank you, Frank. Brent writes Palmer and The Dig. Daniel writes Fluffy, Sayonara, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, The Dig, Dress to Kill, that's the Palmas film, Phoenix, and Hitchcock. Rachel writes, I watched the documentary Fake Famous on HBO. Jessica writes Come Play, The Mandela Effect, Spell, and He's Out There. Susie writes Primal Fear. Tony writes Bicycle Thieves. Bob writes Supernova. Robert Muggy writes Bringing Up Baby, three Japanese noir films, and five Bernard Travenir films. All Criterion Channel. Very good, Robert. Andy writes Bombshell. Mike writes And the Fifth Horseman is Fear. Allison writes Ark, Netflix original. Didn't like it. Movine writes Jane Campion's An Angel at My Table and Christmas Schawow's The German Lesson. Kim writes The Social Dilemma and One Night in Miami. Kevin writes Uncle Frank on Amazon original pick. I highly recommend it. James writes Scars of Dracula. Marshall writes The Little Things. Pace is a little slower than most films, but I like that. Great cast. Jennifer writes Brief Encounter. Charity writes Dunkirk. Robert writes Soul of the Gang. Soul of the Game, sorry. Michael writes The Edge of the City. Kelly writes The Little Things, A Hard Day's Night, and Guys and Dolls. In regards to The Little Things, my expectations were on the low side thanks to the reviews I've read, but I enjoyed it. Kept me mostly pretty riveted, mostly the star power, I guess, but I liked it. Linda writes The Dig. Tracy writes Fake Famous. Andrew writes Sideways, Cutthroat City, and The Social Network. Missy writes Castle Rock and Servant. Ross writes Psycho Gorman, The Godfather, Coda, I'm Your Woman, and Promising Young Woman. Terry writes The Underneath, John McEnroe in The Realm of Perfection, The Girl on a Motorcycle, Mad Love, The Big Country, and The New World. Carrie writes Loving Vincent. Sean writes Cabin in the Sky and Dr. Strangelove. Deb writes The Dig. Ron writes The Dig as well, says lovely. St. Elmo's Fire, still don't get this film of my generation. I'm with you, Ron. Terrible film. And Tough Turf, 80s reimagining of West Side Story without Rita Moreno. Yeah, but it has Kim Richards and James Spader, so there's that. Rich writes The Dig, Palmer, and The Little Things. And finally, Mark writes HUD, Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, The Lighthouse, and Goodfellas. And there you go, friends. So hopefully you got some films to look at, some new or at least new to you titles, as well as falling back on old favorites. And don't forget, Medium Cool, a movie podcast, is the second part of our discussion. It's Austin and Joe Shearer and myself discussing the top 10 films of 2020. We are in part two from this week's episode. So you can check out all of the podcasts there on Medium Cool, a movie podcast. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie, you deserve it. There's plenty out there, you just have to keep digging. Hope you're staying safe, hope you're staying healthy, hope you're staying sane, hope you're being good to one another, and yeah, find some new or new-to-you films as well as falling back on old favorites. And we'll do this again next week. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
to me, to me. Blossom of snow, may you bloom and grow, bloom and grow.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!